This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 28th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Canaletto London. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Bennett. In this episode of the show, we'll be reporting from Rio de Janeiro on the progress of the city's Olympic preparations.
We are right on time on delivering the Venus. We are right on budget, and we are very proud and confident of what we've done so far.
Next up, we're off to Ramallah to see about the design community in the West Bank, as a new exhibition attempts to broach the impact of conflict on Palestinian design.
We see oppression, and especially when you're young, you hope that you can do something about it. So I've been political because I've wanted to change the reality for my family and for my friends.
Plus, we hear about the architectural significance of America's recently reopened embassy in Havana, Cuba. All that to come and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. The Olympic Games are a notorious headache to organise. For any host nation, preparations for one of the world's most watched sporting occasions present a quandary for planners. With 1 year to go until the 2016 Summer Olympics, all eyes are on Rio de Janeiro, as the city gears up to host the first Games in South America. Monocle's correspondent in the city, Sheena Rossiter, strapped on her hard hat and visited some of the construction sites to see how the city's preparations are faring.
Construction is busily underway at the Olympic Village in Recreio, a neighborhood on the fringes of Rio's west zone, far from the golden sand beaches of Ipanema. And in just over a year from now, the doors of these 31 tower blocks will be open to house almost 18,000 athletes, para-athletes, and their technical teams. At 85% complete, the project is well on its way. As Mauricio Cruz, managing director at Ilha Pura, the company behind the project, the Olympic Village is helping shape a new design model in a less developed Rio neighborhood.
It's a big legacy, not only because the residential development of this area, but especially because of the sustainability example that this neighborhood will be. This is the first neighborhood that receives the certificate LEED ND in South America. And now a lot of other companies, they are thinking about doing the same because they understand that sustainability will be something that the clients will demand and will want when they decide to buy their apartments in the future.
And this is just one of many construction sites in the so-called Baja da Tijuca cluster, part of the urban planning for the Games. In fact, this whole part of the city seems to be under construction as the local organizing committee busily prepares for test events which are happening every month from now leading up to the Games. So where are preparations at for the big event?
Where it should be.
That's Leonardo Greiner, the deputy CEO for the Rio 2016 organizing committee.
We are right on time on delivering the venues. We are right on budget, according to what our preparations and plan have planned for this stage of the Games. And we are very proud and confident of what we've done so far. All the venues are being, will be delivered on time for our preparation for the test events.
And some projects, like the Olympic Village, he says, are being constructed at a fast pace.
We are very happy with the work that the developer has done there. They are going to deliver the, according to the schedule. Now we'll have the village before the date was planned.
But for some of Rio's residents, this city's redesign for the Olympics has come at a human cost. In June, police clashed with several local residents at one low-income community, Vila Ojodromo. Rows and rows of houses have been demolished here. What the city has said is part of a relocation plan in order to build infrastructure for the upcoming Olympics. Vila Ojodromo sits just down the road from the newly constructed Olympic Village, and the favela community is just several hundred meters away from the construction site of the Rio 2016 Olympic Park. Few homes are still left standing in Vila Ojodromo, nestled among the piles of rubble and abandoned homes, which have been gutted for spare parts, making the community look desolate as towering new structures are built up just meters away. Most residents here have already left after agreeing to relocate to new apartments provided by City Hall. But some residents, like Maria da Conceição da Silva, are insistent on staying in the community. She tells me that her and her husband are going to try and stay in the community, despite the fact that more people have left. She says she will keep on fighting, and she tells me that she thinks that a lot of the Olympic infrastructure will remain empty and forgotten after the Games are over, similar to what happened during the Pan American Games when Rio hosted them in 2007, she says. Back down the road over at the Olympic Village, plans are already in motion to turn this Olympic Village into luxury apartments after the Games are over. Mauricio Cruz from Ilha Pura says that the Olympic Village apartments won't be a so-called white elephant after the Rio 2016 Games are over.
Well, we started selling apartments by the end of last year. We're keeping selling apartments day by day. Our expectation is to sell all the apartments until the end of 2019. So just after the Olympic Games, we will deliver big part of these apartments for the owners, and they will start living here, and it will be a residential neighborhood.
Tonight, I have the honor to announce that the Games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
No matter what side of the coin Rio's Olympic redesign is looked at, there's one thing that is undeniable. Rio de Janeiro is a city transformed because of the Olympics. Once the Games roll out of town in the fall of 2016, though, many will be watching how Rio's Olympic redesign will operate when it isn't under the International Olympic Committee's watch. For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Design at its core is a process of conceptualizing and creating items that improve people's lives. But how can conflict influence the balance? Haley Joel Ott visited the West Bank city of Ramallah to find out how the atmosphere, strife and political tension is influencing the work of the city's designers. She started her investigation by paying a visit to Disarming Design Palestine, an exhibition and program at the city's International Academy of Art.
Right now, if you want to buy something made in Palestine, you might have to come to a place like where I'm standing, the Central Market in Ramallah. But a company called Disarming Design in Palestine is working to change that by creating functional and artistic products to be marketed and sold internationally. They hope to revitalize the Palestinian design landscape locally while rebranding it abroad.
Hi, my name is Sami Khalidi. I'm the executive director at Disarming Design.
I met up with Sami a few blocks away in the garden of Ramallah's International Academy of Art.
So can you explain what the project is?
The project is essentially marketing special kind of Palestinian arts, so traditional Palestinian arts with a modern design twist or a conceptual design twist.
These products, where do you see them sitting in international markets? Are they art pieces? Are they functional? Do they serve a purpose in the home? What exactly are you selling?
We're kind of in the middle between functional sometimes and between art pieces, because in terms of functionality and design, we can't really compete with the West or, for example, Scandinavia in terms of producing the most, you know, efficient designs or the best in terms of to help you with your daily life. In terms of art pieces, we're also not yet developed enough to be able to give you the best, visually the most appealing sometimes. So what we focus on is the uniqueness of our reality. I think we see things in terms of conflict sometimes, and I think that's quite unique. So in terms of conceptual design, I think that's our main focus. But I also hope that we grow larger and people have these items in their homes. I mean, we're looking for the IKEA customer, not necessarily somebody that's pro-Palestinian, but somebody that's interested in world design and somebody that can see a use of this product.
Can you give me an example of what a reflection of that reality might be?
We have one of the designs. It's really simple. It's a felt ball. There's a certain technique the Palestinians have used to make stuffings of things, which they've used felt for. One of the ideas was to create a rock that would act as a stress ball. So instead of doing a regular stress ball, we did it with felt, and it's based from a rock inside. So the stress ball itself is stressed, but it also looks like a rock. So it draws a comparison between Palestinians being stressed and using rocks as a means of expression and a means of resistance, and as well as, you know, a stress ball trying to relieve your stress.
And disarming design is quite a political name. What does that mean, and what is the context for it?
Disarming design from Palestine is something that stands out, a design that stands out. So, I mean, to me at least, it doesn't have any, you know, that big of a political message, more of a focus on design. We're trying to reflect Palestinian reality, whether good or bad. I mean, we talk about sexuality here in some of our product. We talk about problems with our own leaders. I mean, the corruption and leadership from our side. And we reflect Palestinian reality as a whole. And a huge part of it reflects the occupation's reality.
What is the experience of designers coming up here that perhaps your organization is trying to combat or change?
So if we want to reflect Palestinian reality and Palestinian society, we have to be involved into politics, because politics is a daily thing here. That's what people talk about it every day, and that's what we go through every day. So it's deeply enrooted into our lives now. And it's also deeply enrooted into designers' life, because in the past, I mean, 70s and 80s, all the art work has been focused on creating an artwork that expresses Palestinian resistance. So the art movement in Palestine has, you know, traditionally moved into that direction, as using an art form of expression and resistance. So the artists have that background history. Now it's a bit different, where artists try to reflect their own reality, but their own reality is also deeply enrooted into the political situation. And some of them grew up in harsh atmospheres, and some of them grew up in moderate atmospheres in relation to Palestine. So we have some designs that are extremely political, and others are less so and more focused on, you know, social life or daily experiences. Politics is, I think, in the blood of every Palestinian. I mean, we grew up with it, we see oppression, and especially when you're young, you think, well, I mean, you hope that you can do something about it. I've always seen the injustice firsthand, I've always been humiliated, I've went to jail, I've experienced firsthand oppression, but it's also, I mean, things that impact you the most is that when you see bad things happen to your loved ones and your friends, and then, you know, you can't take it anymore. So I've been political because I've wanted to change the reality for my family and for my friends. So I've been interested in politics to be able to express myself in the same way, you know, to be able to resist and know the best ways of resistance.
That was Haley Joel Ott bringing us that report from the Disarming Design Palestine exhibition and program in Ramallah's International Academy of Art. Still to come on the show, I'll be speaking to the developers of an ingenious new design application. Plus, we find out about the architecture and historic significance of the American Embassy in Havana as it fully reopens.
Location is everything. London's Canaletto Tower is set by water and at the meeting place of four vibrant central London neighbourhoods. It bridges the capital's creative, financial and tech hubs of Shoreditch, Islington, Clerkenwell and the City. A dynamic prime location full of life. Canaletto London and Section D on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now, technology has changed the design industry forever, and everything from the strength of the materials available to the way that furniture is manufactured has changed apace. One important area of progress is the organisation of space, where new technologies are enabling the innovative to project their designs onto empty rooms and see how their furniture, fit-out or new office might look before it arrives. Launching this September at London's Design Festival, Tilco is the Warsaw-based firm behind an application that allows clients to utilise their smartphone to do just that, and envisage how its smart, modular furniture will look in their home before they even buy it. I sat down with co-founders Jacek Majewski, Benjamin Kuna, and Mikolaj Malenda to find out more.
Everything started around 2012. We were pitched to make a scenography and visual identity for a festival that was happening in Warsaw. It was a design and technology festival showcasing how the world changes and what's new to come. So we created a configurator that was put online on the website of the festival. And a few weeks before the festival, people could create their own furniture. It were simple stools that were produced with simple technologies like milling and cheap materials. And we had the configurator for 5 days. And during that 5 days, we had like 600 orders. We choose 60 and we produced them, and they were used during the festival. And after, we gave back them to the creators. And after that, we knew that this is something that people want, that they want to have customized goods, that they want to put a piece of them into the things that they have at their homes.
And so people understand a little more clearly. Could you tell us a little bit what the app does and how it's kind of different from other things on the market?
Yeah, that was the early days. So it was done on the web. But right now we have a pretty advanced tool that is an app that you can download on your iPhone or iPad. It's very simple to use. You can create different types of furniture like shelving system, tables, and pepper and salt mills, and further there will be more products. It uses two technologies. One is parametric modeling that creates how the furniture will look like, and the model defines the boundaries for the furniture, how you can interact with it, and the level of customization. And the second one is augmented reality. It's used to preview the product at your place in the exact spot where the shelving system will be used. So
I've actually been lucky enough to see this product in use, and it projects the furniture, which can then be changed, onto a customer's home. And that to me seems like rather an advanced product. Maybe one of the other co-founders could tell me a little bit about how it was developed and, you know, the actual technology that went into showing people what furniture would like in their house, and also how they can customize it before they buy.
So basically, we started to work on the project having different company operating, because we bootstrapped the project at the beginning. And while we were making different projects for the customers, we're getting more and more experience into the field of augmented reality. And basically, right now, it works in this way that you have to print a tracker. It's just like a simple piece of paper. It's A4 format. And you print it, you place it on the floor. So then the application knows what's the exact scale of the world, and it can project the 3D model right into your house, and it's one-to-one scale, so you don't have to take measurements because you can see it in the real size, and you can walk around it, you can see it from every side, and you can edit it while it's standing in your home.
And how big a part do you think this augmented reality is set to play in the design industry? Obviously, there are advantages to designing furniture in a way that you know exactly how it'll look in a certain space, but also for the consumer, as well as the architect, as well as, you know, there are a number of different avenues. I wonder maybe how the business developed, how it got funded, and how you see it growing, actually, how this technology is going to be part of the everyday.
So there's an interesting story connected with that. Basically, we started fundraising in early 2014, and we approached a couple of European investors, and as we knew that this is a product that's going to thrive in the US market, we needed some investors who would back us from there. So we started approaching a couple of people. One of them was Jason Calacanis, who is the founder of Launch, which is one of the biggest tech conferences in the world. And as we approached him, he was shortly after throwing the biggest event to happen. So we went through the recruitment process there. And just a week before it started, we actually booked tickets and went to San Francisco to present the project for the very first time under a different brand name. And what happened later was that we were picked audience favorite after day one. And later we went on to win the Best Technical Achievement Award at that conference, which was a very prestigious event in the startup scene. So this sort of kickstarted our growth and also our potential in meeting investors, because afterwards they started approaching us rather than we were approaching them. So we really could pick the best possible investors for this project. So we have a mix of European and US investors who are supporting us nearly on a daily basis. And after funding the company, we closed an investment round in November of last year. So we really accelerated our growth. We hired some great people. So we're a team of 28 right now. And yeah, basically that's how it started.
And the official launch, if I'm not mistaken, is at London Design Festival this year. But London is obviously not where you guys come from. You guys are a Warsaw-based studio, and I had the good fortune to actually visit quite recently on a story for the magazine. But I wonder if I could open up to the floor, you know, what it's like to be in Warsaw at the minute. Is there a creative moment that's taking place? Are there a lot of opportunities, or, you know, is design just as hard anyway and you've got to get the product right and it doesn't matter where you're from?
I think that there is a lot of creative tension right now in Warsaw. A lot of people look for opportunities and have them there. So definitely there's something around Warsaw right now that's attractive to a lot of people. And in terms of building companies, I think it's as hard as it is everywhere. Maybe we are more open to try new things right now because there's a lot of new things for us and we just go for it and try to grab the chance that's out there.
That was the team behind Warsaw-based Tilco speaking to me a little earlier. You are listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. With the thawing of diplomatic relations between Cuba and the United States comes the reopening of the American Embassy in Havana. The building is a showcase of international modernism located on a prominent position in Havana's waterfront. It was designed in 1953 by New York architect Harrison and Abramovitz. During the course of the Cold War and beyond, this imposing structure remained unpopular with Cubans, representing, as it did, the perceived arrogance and imperialism of its American builders. In 2006, the Castro regime even erected 138 black flags outside the embassy. These were put up to obscure an electronic message board which had been installed to project news and information from the US State Department. For now, this type of political wrangling is over, and we take the occasion to explore the structure itself and what the significance of its architecture can tell us about the diplomatic messages behind its design. To find out more, we spoke to architect Alejandro Zerapolo, co-founder of London-based Foreign Office Architects, who joined us from Spain.
More than 54 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, the United States closed its embassy in Havana. Today, I can announce that the United States has agreed to formally reestablish diplomatic relations with the Republic of Cuba and reopen embassies in our respective countries.
The embassy in Havana is actually one of the first buildings that are built as part of this operation that was carried out by the Department of State. There was an attempt to convey a certain image of the U.S. worldwide at the time when globalization was taking off, and the buildings that were built display all kinds of conflicts between power that wants to present itself as a kind of modern, democratic, transparent power, and how that architecture that is supposed to convey this image of modernity and transparency and democracy contacts or maybe crashes sometimes with the local identities. This is a building that is built in 1953 by a very important firm in the 50s called Harrison and Abramovitz. It is a firm that has an enormous amount of buildings built over the years. And actually, the Cuban embassy is one of the most modernist ones that they built. Very similar, I think, in a way, to the approach that they used when they built the UN Secretariat, which is this kind of cubic, simple, modernist architecture. What I think is interesting about this, particularly this comparison, is that the UN Secretariat is a steel, glass and steel curtain wall, while in Havana it is a limestone facade, also very regular, very repetitive, very minimal, but with a slightly heavier type of architecture that maybe was a nod to the fact that they were building in Havana in a different climate, perhaps. The building still had some problems. I heard that it didn't work very well in terms of climate performance because it is a slab that is oriented east-west, and that means that it has maximum solar exposure to the facades, and so it basically it is an expensive building to maintain in terms of air conditioning. And so what is very interesting is to see that after Havana embassy, the next buildings tend to be almost systematically more adjusted, more negotiating with the local climates and even with the local architectural traditions. I mean, like, for example, the New Delhi embassy has some sort of lattice that protects the facades from the sun while also providing some sort of veil that was used to make it more secure, or the Baghdad embassy, which was built by José Luis Sert in 55, just 2 days after the Havana embassy, was very much interested in the Masrabiya and this type of sun shading devices that were able to adjust in a way the architecture to the rigors of the local climates. But none of this happened in Havana. What you always see in this type of buildings is this kind of tension between the representation of the values or the languages of the country that is seeking that representation, but also in what way does it negotiate with, for example, the local climate or the local architecture. So in the kind of colonial period, obviously, the embassies that you see are very much almost a direct translation of the British architecture in the Victorian period, or in this case, the American embassies built in the 50s and 60s, the kind of values of democracy and capitalism.
That was Alejandro Zeropolo, co-founder of London-based Foreign Office Architects, speaking to us about the newly reopened American Embassy building in Havana. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, and if you've missed anything of this week's show or are keen to catch up on our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact our show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries or suggestions. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.